Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to the World Soccer Talk Podcast. My name is Christopher Harris and I'm joined by my co-host Kartik Krishnaiyer. Kartik, we're recording this on Monday night after the Manchester United-Liverpool game. We'll get to a whole host of topics this week, including news about Champions League, also Peacock with some new enhancements. We'll also talk about some of the other leagues out there, answering your questions too. But we have to start at Old Trafford. And Kartik, what a difference a win makes. Before this match and early on in this match, United supporters were ready to put the pressure on the Glazers. But a win against a hated enemy changes everything, at least for the time being. What was your take on this match, Kartik?
I guess it changes things for a week, but great performance from United. You saw the intensity that Ten Hag has wanted. You saw the sort of silky play, right? You know, playing between the lines. A guy like Martinez, who he knows so well from Ajax, being able to be a ball-playing center half, which is, of course, what they've wanted for him, but also a very good man-to-man defender. Saw that in this match. You saw a Liverpool team that was lacking in intensity in the first 30 minutes of the match, looked out of sorts, a side that has a disproportionate number of injuries this early in the season. Although I guess there are a lot of teams with injuries right now, which might account for the short summer and the kind of odd dynamic of this season with the World Cup in the winter. But I felt like Manchester United got a boost from that crowd. And I don't know if it was the Casemiro signing that did it, that got the crowd on side, because it felt like in the lead up to this match, and I was talking to people in Manchester, that this was going to be similar to what we saw in, was it April or May of 2021, right? And an abandoned match. And then maybe it was just a smart PR move by Manchester United to say, okay, let's unveil Casemiro. Let's bring him into the stadium. Let's bring him to Old Trafford 3 hours before the match and make a big show of that. And this is a big-time player, right? This is a guy who's won more Champions Leagues than anyone who's playing in the Premier League currently. So if you look at European competition, this is the elite player now in the Premier League. So I guess that created an atmosphere which United fed off of. And I think also the key change for me, in terms of the way Ten Hag set up, other than inserting Varane, I think maybe that's a little harsh on Harry Maguire. I don't think he was the worst player for United the first two matches. But the big change was playing Rashford through the middle instead of playing with a false nine in Christian Eriksen or Sterling Cristiano Ronaldo. And it seemed the movement and the interchange in movement that we saw up top was really, really good from United in this match and kind of just changed the complexion of the way they play. So they kind of overwhelmed Liverpool. Pretty shocking in that sense.
Yeah, On the other side, Kartik, I would argue that I think Klopp underestimated Manchester United in terms of his team selection, starting with the midfield trio of James Milner, Harvey Elliott, and Henderson. And I think to me personally, Jordan Henderson, Fabinho should have started from the beginning. That, I thought, was a weakness there in the middle of the field. But to me, though, and this goes back, this is not just this match, but this is several matches now. Harvey Elliott, I'm not impressed by. I like him as a, you know, passer of the ball, keeping the ball moving, some really clinical passes. But what he's missing is that clinical shot, like in front of the box, when he has half a chance and he's slow to react. And his shots are just not, you need somebody in that position who's going to, you mean a sniff of a goal is just going to go ahead and score, or at least get pretty close to scoring. And I think that's a weakness in this Liverpool side I've seen, both from that starting selection, but also on that right hand side. This is tough though, Kartik. This is for Liverpool now. What, two draws and a loss? I think they're sitting in 16th position. Now with this victory, you mean the pressure's off United, at least temporarily, and now it shifts to Liverpool. A lot of question marks about this Liverpool side. And to me, that was one of the poorest Liverpool performances since, you know, I don't know, it's a very long time. I can't even remember the last time they were this poor.
I guess. I mean, I don't buy into that narrative. I think United still have a long way to go, and this was a great performance in a rivalry, in the biggest rivalry match they have. And Liverpool have a lot of injuries. They have some issues in midfield. I think you're right. Fabinho should have started, most certainly. I think they need to sign a midfielder. You cannot count on Thiago. This is something that Bayern Munich knew also. You couldn't count on Thiago Alcantara. That's why they signed Goretzka when they did, among others, because of injuries and because he's a very kind of specific, he's brilliant in what he does. Don't get me wrong, but he's a very specific kind of midfielder. So I think we're looking at a situation now where Liverpool will get fit. They will maybe sign another midfielder. I guess they're not going to. So if they don't, maybe that's why they won't win the title. But my prediction is, and I know this sounds like a contrarian hot take, 6 months from now, Liverpool will be 10 points, 15 points, something like that, ahead of Manchester United, and we won't really remember this match.
Yeah, I can see that happening. However, Liverpool needs to get its acting gear. I mean, from what they were shown us just a few weeks ago in the Community Shield and how good they were in that performance to what they were today. And yes, definitely Manchester United showed up in this game really aggressively from the very beginning. And I liked what I saw. I liked that Ten Hag was ready to make those big decisions by sitting Maguire. And I think Maguire needs a break. It's been a long 12 months. He's been under a lot of pressure. And then sitting Ronaldo, sitting Fred, and bringing on kind of a squad that actually were fighting for it. We're really, really going for it. One thing I noticed, two things I noticed.
One thing I should just say real quickly, Fred looked incredibly motivated when he came on and played brilliantly, right? He came on for the last 25 minutes or so. So benching a guy like him, a guy of good character like him, could motivate him. I don't know about Ronaldo. It may do the opposite with Cristiano, but yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, two things I noticed from this game were in terms of the television broadcast. One is that NBC Sports' halftime analysis was much, much better. So compared to the criticism we gave them last week for kind of their mediocre or average halftime analysis, this time much, much better, and some really good insight by Tim Howard and then Robbie Musto also. And then the other thing too, Kartik, we haven't talked about this season thus far, but Peter Drury, how good he is, and also too, I mean, teamed up with Lee Dixon, who to me is my favorite co-commentator in that NBC Sports crew. But Drury and Lee Dixon, I mean, together in the gantry at Old Trafford before the match, some really good analysis, and off we go. And I mean, for me, Peter Drury hasn't made a mistake all season.
Yeah, and he's been brilliant. It's really upgraded NBC's coverage. One little pet peeve about NBC today, which was Rebecca Lowe really coming after Robbie Musto after the Ten Hag interview, which was done with Jamie Carragher and Phil Neville was, or excuse me, Gary Neville. Gary Neville and Jamie Carragher was aired on Peacock. I thought Musto made some very reasonable points, and I, maybe it's my own biases. I agree entirely with Musto's analysis, and it seemed like Rebecca Lowe wanted to push him and that he wasn't, she wasn't buying what he was saying. Just, I think, to kind of be sort of provocative, which maybe I shouldn't blame her. I think she was just taking after what Carragher and Neville did in the interview, which was came across as a bit of an ambush. But that was my one critique, negative critique of their coverage. Otherwise, they were very good pregame. They were very good post-match, the post-match to the point that I've seen. Obviously, we're recording this post-match. And halftime, much improved. Really good studio. And look, Tim Howard is – I think Tim Howard is making, I've said for a few years, I think he makes good points. He's just not savvy in when he makes those points or how he makes those points. Now, I think he's getting the cadence, the flow, the sort of timing of a broadcast and of a quick, tight halftime show better than he has in previous seasons. So I think he's, you give him maybe most improved along with the fact that they brought Peter Drury in. And let's face it, Chris, for fans like you and I, who have been critical of NBC in the past, replacing Arlo White with Peter Drury, if you can make one transfer, like one move for a network, that is the dream move. That is effectively like signing Messi or Ronaldo, right? and replacing, you know, some average striker with Messi or Ronaldo. So it's brilliant. I mean, Peter Drury being there makes the whole presentation, the whole performance from NBC Sports that much better.
Yeah, and that's our gain here in the United States, and then the loss actually for the world feed, because Peter Drury no longer calling games for the Premier League on the world feed. So we get to hear him and see him every week, week in, week out, calling even sometimes 2 to 3 games a weekend. So yeah, it's a great pleasure to have him on this side of the Atlantic in terms of the television, even though he's obviously broadcasting from the UK. So one thing I think, Kartik, in our season preview of the Premier League, we went through all of the 20 clubs. And for me, so far this season, and it's only 3 games in, right? But so far this season, I think the trends look like our predictions look like they're trending in the right direction, which I think Bournemouth, poor defensively, a lot of question marks about them in terms of whether they can stay up this season. Aston Villa, under a lot of pressure with Steven Gerrard, still not punching at their weight. I mean, to me, they're punching below their weight. Leicester falling apart defensively, not making many transfer moves to bring players in to freshen up the squad. A lot of question marks about that. Everton, who I predicted would get relegated, maybe not looking that bad, but still a lot of question marks about them. Nottingham Forest flying high. Southampton getting better and better after every game, and after they got thrashed in the opening game against Spurs. Palace on fire under Zaha. And then Wolves for me have been bucking the trends a little bit. To me, they actually looked much better in that game against Tottenham than they did in the first 2 weeks of the season. And then Fulham and Brentford, I mean, to me, which was one of the games of the weekend, other than Newcastle, Man City, of course, and Leeds and Chelsea. There was a lot to choose from, a lot of really good matches to pick from. But the Fulham and Brentford one was a really entertaining West London derby. What for you, though, Kartik, any trends, those predictions that we gave preseason, are you surprised by anything that we've seen thus far after 3 games?
I do think that Brentford hit the ground running better than I thought they would. Yes, they lost this match to Fulham, but they fought back. They were probably unfortunate. There was a couple of controversial calls in that match. So that's a little surprising to me. Fulham, I thought, would be better than people thought they were because of what I saw last season in the championship, but were kind of disappointed by their lack of transfer activity. prior to prior to when we recorded, Chris. And then by the time the season began, they had made a couple of the moves that I had hoped they'd made earlier in the summer. I think Aston Villa, we were spot on. I don't know how many more weeks Steven Gerrard has. I think that side's underachieving more than any side in the division. Leicester, concerns are there. You were more concerned about them than I was. I'm now kind of with you. I'm very concerned about them. And I have to give you a hat tip about Palace. They have looked, outside of the first 20 minutes against Arsenal in the first match, looked very good, even in defeats, even in draws. They look a really tidy side. Southampton, I want to caution the listeners, Southampton will be up and down all season because they have so many young players. They're so reliant on young players. They have a great manager in Hasenhüttl. He's the right guy for a team like this. But my sense would be they're going to throw up some stinkers, some clankers during the season. They're also going to throw up some amazing results. They may beat Manchester City. They may beat Arsenal. And then you might also see them lose a match to Bournemouth. That's how difficult it is to play as many young players as Southampton's playing. So, yeah, I think the trends are pretty spot on. The only team I would disagree with you on is Everton. That's the team we disagreed about preseason. They have 1 point. That's it. I concede that. But I see it coming together. They've had a lot of injuries. And given the number of injuries they've had and the lack of transfer activity until late, I think they've played pretty well in the three matches, to be honest with you.
Yeah, but still, I think with Frank Lampard, he still makes these late substitution decisions in games. So the last 10 minutes of the game against Forest, I think he brought on Onana. And you mean, again, he changes the game slightly and Everton come back and get an equalizer. But why is he waiting so late in these games to make these decisions? Because Everton finish the games really well, but start pretty poorly.
Yeah, that's a great, great point. The thing that I've critiqued Lampard, Gerrard, a couple other managers for this season is that they're still operating in a three subs world where they want to hold on to a sub or two until late. In fact, the opposite of this is Thomas Frank, right? Thomas Frank has made earlier substitutions. He didn't have to the second week, right, against United because they blew him out of the building. But he's made earlier substitutions against Leicester and against Fulham that have impacted the match. Also, since we're on this subject, Chris, I should mention Pep Guardiola had one substitution against Newcastle, which was a forced substitution due to Ake's injury. No other substitutions. This is something that I have to say annoys me about Pep. We saw it last season, the game against West Ham at the end of the season, when Man City fall behind 2-0 at the Olympic Stadium, need to rescue a point there to go into the final week of the season ahead of Liverpool, and he doesn't make a substitution the entire match. So in the world of five substitutions, where Pep Guardiola is even unwilling to use three substitutions, and quite frankly, Manchester City doesn't have the depth they've had in previous years. We've talked about that. Maybe that's going to be what gets them.
Yeah, it's interesting in some ways, though, too. There's like, for managers, I mean, part of it is ego, I think, in terms of like, hey, I set this team up. I gave them the direction to go out there. I picked the starting lineup. And this is the team that's going to go carry us all the way to the victory. And Pep, I kind of sense that in terms of like, hey, I know better than the fans in attendance who might be calling for substitutions or looking at me saying like, hey, why aren't you bringing on more subs? Frank Lampard, though, that's a good point, Kartik, about in terms of living in a world now where, you mean, he's maybe kind of thinking three subs in his mind or kind of gotten so used to that. But now with the new substitution rules in terms of the endless possibilities, it seems, maybe hasn't evolved in that regard. But out of all the matches you watched this weekend, and I watched a bunch too from La Liga, I mean, the Real Madrid, Barcelona games, Serie A with Inter Milan, Bundesliga with Dortmund against Werder Bremen, which is a fantastic comeback. But out of all the matches you watched this past weekend, Kartik, which one was your favorite?
Wow. I guess Well, favorite is a subjective term, right? So I guess I'll say Leeds 3-0 over Chelsea because I'm steeped in the history of that derby, that rivalry, and was really excited for Jesse Marsh and really excited for Leeds supporters at Elland Road, and also continue to be perplexed by Tuchel's decisions. I guess the most entertaining match, unfortunately, was the Dortmund-Bremen match, which I say unfortunately because I think that just ends the Bundesliga title race dead in its tracks in week three. But Dortmund's up 2-0. I infamously tweet that maybe I was wrong. Maybe we do have a title race this season because Dortmund has shored up their back line, unlike previous seasons. And then what happens? That was the kiss of death, that tweet. So for those of you who don't know, Bremen scored three times, and that was that. And that's that for the title race, because the next day Bayern goes out and wins 7-0, so it's over.
It's hard, though. I mean, if you're a fan of the French Football League, I mean, Ligue 1, or the Bundesliga, it's hard, right? It's hard when PSG wins 7-1. It's hard when Bayern Munich wins 7-0. And it's hard because it's like you want that entire league to be as competitive as possible. And you see in the Premier League, at least in terms of, you mean, Brighton or Brentford, or, you mean, these teams that are, in quotation marks, underdogs, when in reality they're not underdogs, because, you mean, the amount of money that they have to buy in the transfer window is far greater than most clubs in La Liga or the Bundesliga or the French League. But, however, you don't get as many of those blowouts, and you don't get a season where, by the third week, the season feels like it's effectively over. It feels like in Germany and in France, we already know who's going to win it. You could have said that after week two, perhaps. Week three was kind of like, hey, let's hope and maybe something will change, like you said, Kartik, in that tweet. But it comes back to slap you in the face. So, but in terms of the matches I watched this weekend, I missed the Newcastle-Manchester City match. I watched the highlights, spending time with my family. But the Leeds-Chelsea game was enthralling. Really, really amazing to watch. Preseason, too, in our preseason previews, we warned about Chelsea. We said we had a lot of doubts about this team. And Thomas Tuchel, especially, we've been kind of harsh on him. Maybe not harsh, maybe unbiased and maybe fair. But this game was, for an American, incredible to watch, entertaining. The fans, I mean, in terms of Elland Road, we've been talking about this for years, ever since, well, actually, even before they were in the Premier League. What a great fan base that is. And if you go back to the 1970s, or even the early 1980s, Leeds against Chelsea would be one of the matches that you would want to avoid as a spectator, as a supporter, as a fan, because those are the games that you would have seen massive amounts of hooliganism. You would have seen, I mean, whether it's knives or rocks or just violence. Leeds against Chelsea was the hardcore of the hardcore.
It actually, yeah, it was the hardcore of the hardcore. And I was going to point out it often would start before the match. So I've heard stories, not for many years, but I was fairly networked with Leeds fans at one point, 10, 15 years ago. Chris, I may have even told you some of these stories privately, but I've heard from Leeds supporters about the times that Leeds hooligans would go to West London early in the week of a match, of a Chelsea-Leeds match, scout where the headhunters, you know, where they worked, how, what bus route they took, what tube route they took. So basically they could start the Friday before the Saturday match, they would know exactly where they were to jump them or engage in violence. So it was not only you would want to avoid the Chelsea-Leeds match, you would want to avoid West London or Yorkshire or Leeds the week of the match. That's how bad it was. I mean, it was crazy rivalry. For those of you who don't know about this rivalry, just look it up on Wikipedia. It's one of the few derby matches that is not a derby, but it's a cross-sectional rivalry in England that has its own Wikipedia page because of the intensity of that.
So it's great to see how things have changed so much, though, Kartik. I mean, glorious sunshine in Yorkshire. I mean, a really fantastic game. I think personally, I mean, I was really happy with this result because, I mean, I'm a neutral. But however, you know, I mean, Leeds have definitely punched above their weight thus far. They've impressed me. However, I just still don't see this lasting throughout the season. I mean, basically, enjoy it while you can, because I think it's going to get tougher for Leeds. Clubs will figure out ways to really kind of punish them on the counter as Leeds push up the pitch. But
I'm not sure when listeners are going to listen to this and if it would have happened yet or not, but I'm told Newcastle's going to launch another transfer bid for Jack Harrison. So losing that specific player, I think, is something Leeds can't absorb at this point.
So where does Chelsea go from here, though, Kartik? I mean, again, we're recording this on Monday night. The transfer window is still open. I mean, there's still plenty of time. There's been a lot of talk about more players coming in. It seems that Todd Bowie, the club chairman at Chelsea, the owner at Chelsea, seems to be kind of making offers for anyone who's interested or anyone that's available. Very haphazard buying strategy, it seems, but how do you turn this around, though? I mean, like, what do you do if you're Tuchel?
Yeah, it's the Frankenstein buying strategy is what a Chelsea fan has coined it to me privately. I think that's what he called it, Frankenstein. But basically, it's just all of these different pieces, this kind of very random buys, generally buying guys who play the same position on top of guys who are already there, which makes no sense. And then a new manager comes in, inherits a squad, doesn't like the guys he has, and I don't think it makes any sense. And the other thing I will say, I think as a tactical observation about this match is that, or a player observation, is that Conor Gallagher is a different kind of midfielder from what Chelsea's had for a long time. I don't think they've had a central midfielder quite as dynamic in his range of passing and movement as Gallagher since a withdrawn central midfielder since Michael Essien. I'm forgetting any guys in between that have been as dynamic as Gallagher. So adjusting to having Gallagher in that midfield will take some time, but I didn't feel like Tuchel's tactics lent itself to that. What Tuchel's tactics lent itself to was Gallagher being isolated in midfield and being pounced upon by a press from Leeds. And I just think that unless there's some sort of tactical rethink from Tuchel, some willingness to play through the middle of the pitch, Stamford Bridge, where their home ground, is a very narrow pitch. So I should point this out. So I think playing through the wide areas through Reece James and through Chilwell or now Cucurella on the right. Or Loftus-Cheek started this match as a right wing back. That is a little different at Stamford Bridge than it is at some wider pitches in England. So what I'm finding with Chelsea now, kind of as a trend over the last, I wouldn't say the first that first year Tuchel was there, but the last 15 months, let's say, is this: away from home, they're struggling often in matches because they're playing down the flanks, they're playing in wide areas, they're not playing through the middle, and their midfield's getting overwhelmed. Regardless of who's in the midfield, whether it's, Mount plays very well, but Mount's isolated up top. Whether it's Conte and Jorginho or Jorginho and Kovacic, Jorginho, Gallagher in this match, Loftus-Cheek has played a little bit in central midfield last season. So I think there has to be a tactical rethink. Tuchel can keep signing guys. Boley seems willing to spend millions and tens of millions of pounds on augmenting a squad that already has more players than any other side in the league, right? They have more recognizable guys. I mean, they still have guys like Billy Gilmore and Batshuayi and Ross Barkley, among others, on their books.
Yeah.
So it's crazy. They keep signing guys. So, yeah, you're asking me what can they do between now and the end of the transfer window? I don't know, because they're just going to keep signing guys, it seems like. Is there any guy that can make a major difference for them? I think Aubameyang maybe does, okay, for 6 months, which is, again, very Chelsea, right? Very short term. Aubameyang comes in. We know it didn't end well for him at Arsenal, but we know how good he's been in the Premier League, right? 20 goals a season a few times during his Arsenal career. So maybe he has a good season, and they just paper over the cracks, and 12 months from now, they're trying to buy another striker. after Aubameyang has come on loan or whatever and done well for them, or come for a year and hits 34 and begins to decline. So there's no long-term solution here. And if they get Aubameyang, okay, maybe they fight for fourth a little harder than it looks like they're fighting now. But yeah, sorry, Chris, for the long answer, but that's generally my view of what's going on at Chelsea. It's just, I think, aimless it would be the term I would use in terms of their bigger picture thinking.
Yeah, Aubameyang to me is not the answer. I mean, to me, like, I just did not like him at Chelsea at Arsenal in terms of the way he played. He often got in the way. You mean Lacazette would take a shot and then Oba would be in the way or block it or would, you mean, accidentally hit it or would deflect it away from goal? Or I just don't think he's as good as he was when he was playing for Dortmund. However, I do think that Chelsea need a striker, and I think Sterling's a good player in terms of kind of possessing the ball, keeping the ball moving, and then cutting in from kind of the left, cutting to the right. However, I think you do need someone right down the middle, kind of a number nine, that's going to be that target striker for Chelsea. Who that is, I don't think it's Alba, but I'm sure there's a striker in the market somewhere. I mean, but even Broja too. I mean, Broja, I'd like to see him being utilized more, because I think he could actually, we've seen that with Southampton, he can actually score the goals if given an opportunity. And that's the thing though too, talking about being given an opportunity, Christian Pulisic once again on the bench, coming on late. You mean too late to really make much of a difference. And some people in social media freaking out, right?
I mean, he's been given so many opportunities. You know, let's just end this discussion here, right? He's been given, Tuchel, I think, likes him, actually. And he liked him at Dortmund and was partial to him when he came into Chelsea. So he's tried him in several different roles to see where he can stick. And, you know, at some point you have to start realizing maybe the guy doesn't train well. Maybe there's some other issue. This is three successive managers he's had. Lucien Favre at Dortmund, Lampard at Chelsea, and then Tuchel now, that have you know, had some questions about the guy and not made him an automatic starter, and have seemingly tried to give him chances and play him in certain roles, and he's great one match and then he's not good the next, and then he gets injured. So at some point, pundits in the U.S. and U.S. fans have to understand the coaches. And there's a growing consensus about Pulisic now among even pundits in the UK. They see something that maybe you don't see. They're seeing these guys every day. Have some respect for that. And I'm a guy who's not a Tuchel defender, right? I've just spent however many minutes slamming Tuchel's tactics and the flow and the guys they're buying. But he's come to a judgment on Pulisic after trying him in several different roles. And in none of those roles was he, and this is the last point I'll make on this, Chris. You can't just watch highlight clips. You can't just see, oh, they played Burnley and he had a hat trick. Okay? You have to be consistently good at top clubs. You have to be consistent every day. You have to train like you play a game on match day. You have to train at that level. You have to train the way Frank Lampard did when he was at Chelsea. And since Lampard was one of Pulisic's managers, Lampard was not the most gifted player in terms of his skill level or his natural qualities. He trained like you wouldn't believe, and he was, you know, a thinking man's footballer too. You have to bring it every single day at big clubs like Chelsea, and then when you get your chance, you have to make the most of it, and you have to be consistent, and you can't constantly be getting injured. So he's had great moments. He's had some great matches. There's no question his skill level is, I think, you know, his skill level is top 25 in the world in terms of attacking players. But there's something else missing, and at some point, the people who keep whining about this have to understand that, have to respect this. This is year four for him at Chelsea, and say, well, you know, maybe he is better off at Everton or Newcastle or Lille or Napoli or some other place where maybe there isn't as much of a burden on him. He doesn't have to train as hard. There isn't as much competition for places. Maybe there's a cultural comfort somewhere else other than London for him. I mean, there are all these factors that could be playing in, but I'm just sick and tired of it personally. And I think I sense you are as well.
Yeah. There's definitely no agenda against Christian Pulisic. It is, I mean, just coaches making coaching decisions. And if he's not playing, it's not because Tuchel hates him or, you mean, basically in terms of the fit within the squad. And like you said, he's had plenty of chances. And I had a chuckle too when you mentioned the Burnley game, because in the back of my mind, I was going to say, like, hey, well, what do we remember Pulisic for at Chelsea? And definitely some goals in the Champions League, which were, I mean, great. But that Burnley hat trick was kind of probably the most vivid memory in my mind too, where he scored those goals. And it's Burnley. No offense against Burnley, but it's not, you're not playing Real Madrid or, I mean, PSG and scoring a hat trick type of thing. So the competitive level and to be a starter on that squad, playing week in, week out, it's tough, really, really tough. And I think many ways too. I mean, Chelsea signing Raheem Sterling should send a massive signal to Pulisic. I think he needs to move, because otherwise this is going to be a miserable season for him. He will get chances if he stays with Chelsea, but nowhere near as much as he wants and nowhere as near as much as he needs to be ready for the World Cup.
Yeah, compared to Weston McKennie, if we're going to have this conversation about Americans, Weston McKennie has gotten suspended and worked his way back into the team. Weston McKennie has gotten injured and worked his way back into the team. Then McKennie had what looked like would be a three-month injury, and he got back in 3 or 4 weeks and worked his way back into the team. And Juventus is the same high-level club as Chelsea. So this is not a statement about Americans. It's a statement about Pulisic specifically, because McKennie is an American, and he has shown he can hang at the highest level. And he has shown he will fight tooth and nail to get his position back at the highest level. So I just want to make that clear. This isn't, oh, I don't think American players are good or they don't have the same mentality. There's something about Pulisic. He needs to move. Maybe it'll all work out wherever he goes. But just contrast him with McKennie in what I'm saying.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
All right, Kartik, let's move on to TV streaming news. And this one came late in last week after we recorded the podcast. However, it's really important to share the big news out of the United States.
Yeah, CBS re-upping for 6 years, which is in addition to the 2 years, or I guess we've started the next to last season, but we haven't had the group stage yet. So they basically have 8 more years of UEFA Champions League, UEFA Europa League, UEFA Conference League in English. This means that the 6 years, first 6 years under the new format, which is a larger group stage, they will have huge news, cement CBS, who have done their best to really improve the visibility and popularity of the UEFA Champions League and of UEFA club competitions in general to the product in a similar way. NBC is now synonymous with the Premier League in the United States. So I think this is a big move for UEFA and for UEFA club competitions in the United States. Whether you like CBS's coverage or not, and I certainly, and same with you, Chris, we've certainly had our critiques about it, there is no question they have improved the visibility of the competitions, and they have tied a large broadcast network in the United States to UEFA club competitions. And as I said, I've seen promotion for Champions League on other CBS sporting events, college basketball, golf, etc., in a way that the Champions League didn't get when they were on Turner. They didn't get when they were on Fox. They didn't get actually even way back when they were on ESPN. So this is a big move, I think, for UEFA. It shows how happy they are with what CBS has produced the first 2 years of having the Champions League. Is it 2 seasons now? I guess 2.5 seasons now. And of course, Chris should mention that they fended off heavy competition from Amazon.
Yeah, no, this is great news for CBS and for soccer fans in the United States. I think the reason is that it gives us a consistent home for the English language rights. I mean, we had a few years where it went from Fox to Turner to CBS. It seemed to be kind of hot potato passed around. But here with CBS, like you said, to Kartik, 8 more years before the deals expire, which gives it that consistency, makes it easier for soccer fans to find these games. The deal, so English language rights in the US, $250 million a year. What it doesn't include yet is the Spanish language rights. Those are still up for bid, and it looks like UEFA is going to wait and see in terms of the Spanish language streaming side, to see the competition building up there. I think the competition really is it's VIX Plus. I mean, VIX Plus recently launched as a paid streaming service. Still a long way to go. I'm sure they're wanting to increase the number of subscribers to that, trying to make sure that that's going to be something that's going to work for the Spanish language audience. And at the same time, maybe Peacock in Spanish or some of the other Spanish language providers, seeing what they do and see how they grow. So I think that's where we're at, is that actually once the deal's done, we'll find out how much the Spanish language rights go for. In terms of some of the other news that came out too, we're recording this on Monday. ESPN Plus is increasing their price to $9.99 a month. And then also on the annual plan, if you happen by chance to listen to this podcast on Monday night, go ahead and sign up for the annual plan, because you'll save $30. You can get it for $69.99 before the price increases, I guess, at midnight on Monday night. August 23rd is when the price goes up. Kartik, Fox has announced some World Cup news for Qatar.
Yeah, they plan on taking 30 media personalities, on-air personalities to Qatar, and will be calling all of the games from its stadiums, stadium for all 63 matches of the tournament. So that's pretty unbelievable given what Fox did last time in Russia and what we've seen Fox do, quite honestly, in several previous tournaments, right, where they called everything off a monitor. Even Women's World Cup, they would have, I think, 2 teams they sent to France, right, and the other three were off a monitor. Other 3 teams were calling things off a monitor. So, and also an upgrade. Granted, we were in a COVID type world, Chris, but ESPN had, I think, 1 team really on the ground for the entire tournament in the Euros last year. And then John Champion and Taylor Twellman eventually joined them for the quarterfinals onward. But so a pretty big upgrade on what we've seen recently in broadcast television for major tournaments in the U.S. in terms of that. And I know for a lot of you guys out there, it doesn't matter to you. For both Chris and I, it does matter. We can tell when commentators not in the ground.
Yeah, for sure. And then last but not least, Peacock. We interviewed executives from Peacock just this week, and we have 3 different articles at worldsoccertalk.com that go into a lot of detail about Peacock. Some of the highlights, just real fast, 4K. Games in 4K are coming to Peacock in 2023. The article will go into more detail about that. They've also got new features on Peacock for the Premier League viewing experience, including catch up with key plays, which is interesting because when you're watching a Premier League match, say you join the game late, you can actually see some thumbnails where it's key plays that have happened in the minutes that you missed, and you can go to those key plays pretty easily to watch it. And then click a button to go back to the point that you left off on, so you don't miss any of the match, and you get to see the key plays that you would have missed in the first few minutes. Plus, there's a whole bunch of other new features too. So they've improved the navigation. But for all the details, go to worldsoccertalk.com and to the homepage, and you'll see there's I think about three articles going into in depth in our interviews with Peacock executives. Let's move on to listener mailbag. First up is Chris talking about the whip-around shows that we talked about last week. Chris says, when it comes to whip-around shows, I absolutely love them because it allows me to see the action from every match and see results in real time. This is especially true of Major League Soccer, especially when it comes to the final match day of the regular season, where playoff places are determined. In fact, the concept of a whip-around show is being extended to other sports, such as Big Ten college football, and even the NFL via the Red Zone. Speaking of the Big Ten, they are likely to announce at the end of this week, which would have been last week, that they have a new deal with Fox, CBS, and NBC, ending 40 years of partnership with ESPN. With this in mind, do you see ESPN putting in more of an effort to acquire the World Cup or other tournaments in the future, Kartik?
Yes, I think the Big Ten loss is a big blow to them. Now, the Big Ten thing, I talked about this a little bit privately with you, Chris, the other day. The Big Ten thing is a case of the disenfranchised other networks ganging up on ESPN, right? So it took a combined effort of NBC, CBS, and Fox joining hands to take a property away, although Fox has had a role with the Big Ten for a while also, but it was a Big Ten Fox split, but joining hands, basically Fox propositioning CBS and NBC to create this situation, because ESPN is now into exclusivity. So ESPN would have, the threat was ESPN may take the Big Ten away completely at some point, like they've taken away other conferences and other properties. So yeah, I do think there's an opportunity for that. I think you will see them really go hard after the FIFA rights in 2030, or starting with the 2027 Women's World Cup, and then in terms of the Euros, they will not be able to get that back till 2032. But I think they will try to get that back. Now, I have to say, even though we don't know the numbers publicly, my information is, and Chris, you may be able to corroborate this, Fox significantly outbid ESPN for the Euro rights. It wasn't that they just topped their bid. They paid significantly more than ESPN was willing to pay. Now that ESPN doesn't have the Big Ten and they're not going to be able to bid on that for some time, maybe that changes the situation where more cash would be available. So I do think it's a pretty big deal. And I think it's also a pretty big deal from a programming perspective for the other three networks that have the Big Ten, something we'll get into another time.
Yeah. Yeah. The tricky thing about that too, I mean, obviously, ESPN lost the rights to U.S. men and U.S. women games, and will lose the streaming rights to MLS. But they also overpaid for La Liga. So, in comparison to some of these, the World Cup rights or Big Ten and these other things, those are much larger. But still, overpaying for La Liga and still trying to maximize that as much as possible, get as many signups.
To be honest, Chris, I had forgotten how much they'd overpaid for La Liga until the article I wrote the other day at World Soccer Talk, kind of doing some side-by-side comparison of properties, which I did in preparation to write that article after we found out the news. And I couldn't believe that effectively they're paying almost as much for La Liga for a season as CBS is going to pay for the Champions League with this new format. With the broker fee, although it's the same broker, actually, but the broker fee built in. So that shocked me. actually. Now maybe La Liga bounces back, Chris. I mean, they're got La Liga in an era without Ronaldo, without Messi. Maybe Lewandowski being there. Maybe Mbappe does eventually go there. Although it's looking more and more doubtful, right? I mean, he now has control of PSG effectively. They really needed one of those stars in La Liga to make that $217 million a year or so worthwhile. And, yeah, they tremendously overpaid for La Liga, is correct.
All right, so two more comments from listeners. And listeners, I do apologize that usually we have a lot more questions, which we do have a bank of them. However, a little bit under the weather today, so just trying to motor through these and maybe next week we'll go ahead and dive a little bit more into those that we haven't read thus far. But Nick is next. Nick says, with the gulf between the Premier League and everybody else continuing to grow, I wonder how you see this trend playing out in the long term. I can't see any way the other leagues and clubs can close the gap without something that's currently unimaginable happens. I hate the idea of a Super League, but I don't think big clubs on the continent will sit around waiting to be fully relegated to status as Premier League feeder clubs. The reality is we already have a Super League. It's called the English Premier League, and these are already six permanent members in all but name. I was thinking about that the other day too, Kartik, too. I was thinking about after the PSG games and Bayern games on Sunday, and I'm like, I mean, PSG and Bayern are so far ahead of those teams in that same league. They need to be in a Super League. They need to be playing against these bigger teams to be more competitive. Otherwise, it dilutes the regular season of their leagues. But Nick's points about the Premier League being the Super League, he's right, the breakaway clubs that wanted to have who are actually still trying to do the Super League, the Juventus's, Real Madrid's, and Barcelona's, do you think there's a way for them to establish something, a competitive Super League or something that is going to change their futures?
In theory, yes, but I think as time goes on, the hegemony of those six big English clubs and the Premier League in general becomes stronger and stronger and stronger. So if you launch a Super League in 10 years from now, it's possible launching a Super League with Real Madrid, Barcelona, Juventus is meaningless to large parts of the world. It'd be big in Latin America, big in Italy, big in Spain, right? So, that's maybe big in Japan. Although, actually, in Asia now, it seems like the Bundesliga is overtaking La Liga. So, that's the danger. I mean, you can't do this without English clubs, and English clubs now have one less incentive to jump to a Super League with the improved TV deals and the growing advantage they have, and two, realize that their supporters will never tolerate them joining a Super League after what happened 18 months ago. So, or 15 months ago, whenever it was. It may happen, a Super League. I still don't think a Super League can really compete with the Premier League.
So, like a rhetorical question, but which is more important, the club, a club or a league? And to me, it's one of those things where if you're a fan of Real Madrid, you're sitting pretty. You're like, hey, we're the champions of Europe. We're one of the best teams. Winning La Liga. Relatively easily. I mean, it's definitely a tough fight, but it's not like it's fierce competition where it's neck and neck down to the final game of the season. However, it has been in recent years, but not this past season. Bayern Munich, same thing too. If you're a fan of Bayern Munich, you're loving life. You're like, hey, we are so powerful. We're dominating the German league. We're going to win again. A record, 11th title in a row. We're competitive within the Champions League. So if you're a fan of a major club, whichever major club it is, maybe you prioritize club in terms of how well they're doing and not put so much focus on the league. Maybe just put the focus on winning trophies.
And then
what happens to everyone else though, right? What happens to the other teams in that league and the other teams that get demolished by those teams? Ultimately, I think at the end of the day, with the Premier League, at least, it is more competitive, so it is more watchable. So the league, I mean, Manchester United would say that they're more, probably bigger and more powerful than the Premier League is. I disagree with that, but the Premier League as a whole is a lot more powerful in terms of the global TV rights they're getting because of the brand and how watchable that league is. It's hard to remember, Kartik, a really boring game from the Premier League. We're 3 weeks into the season. Yeah, there were some 0-0 matches, but even some of the 0-0 matches were pretty entertaining. It's pretty rare that you'll see kind of a drab match. You can watch other leagues, and just sometimes, I mean, not every game is going to be good. Some games will be boring. Some games will be not much creativity. However, with the Premier League this season, more than any, you're seeing that creativity every game. I mean, to me, am I wrong?
Yeah,
am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. In fact, I mean, this goes back to what I've been saying for a while, which is, and I used to hammer the Premier League for this. You know, I used to say, hey, I'd rather watch a Serie A match, an average Serie A match, than an average Premier League match. I'd rather watch the Bundesliga was more entertaining, and Serie A, there was more tactics. But now, the tactical variation, and I've been saying it, as I said, for a few years, the tactical variation in the Premier League is unlike any league I've ever seen in my history of watching football. You don't have 20 distinct styles, but you have 20 semi-distinct styles within the league, and maybe 8 to 10 distinct styles, or 6 to 8 distinct styles. I haven't really thought about this. Maybe this is a good premise for a written article, but you don't have that in other leagues. So every match by nature is going to be interesting, Chris, because teams are doing things tactically, tweaking formations, tweaking setups, the way they play, how they attack, based on the opposition and based on their philosophy, which is radically different than, I mean, you could argue the Bundesliga, if you just like goals, okay, then maybe you should watch the Bundesliga and not watch other leagues. But I would argue every team in Germany plays basically the same way, with one or two exceptions. They've gotten really far down the road of gegenpressing and coming out and playing that way, right? And playing between the lines and a lot of diagonal movement in the Bundesliga. So I just think that's part of it with the Premier League. It's just brilliant in terms of its variety, its variation, as well as its quality.
And then last but not least, we have an email from John Lambert, and he says about soccer documentaries. He says, for the question about soccer documentaries, Six Dreams on Prime is good for La Liga. Haven't found a good one with English subtitles and available to stream now for the Bundesliga that's good. The Dortmund and FC Bayern ones on Prime are bland and club-sponsored. And that's been my criticism for a lot of the All or Nothing documentaries I've seen, not even just All or Nothing, some of the other ones that are put out by the clubs themselves, is that they're so censored and so really kind of basically, you know, not fake, but inauthentic in terms of it, not giving a real reality of what that club is like, but painting a picture, basically a kind of a PR exercise, having these documentaries put together that it doesn't really make a connection, doesn't connect me with the actual club itself. It seems fake, and for the most part too, that's why I've had a tough time finding documentaries that I like, and actually I've been burned out by documentaries. However, Kartik, Wednesday, I'm going to give this one a chance, and I'm looking forward to it. I'm biased on this one, but Welcome to Wrexham, the series is starting on Wednesday. And that's going to be on FX. We'll have more details on the website, worldsoccertalk.com, about where you can find it and what time it starts, etc. But going into this, what are your hopes for this one? Do you think this could be a Sunderland Till I Die part one?
Yeah, it definitely will be, because I don't want to give the teaser as to how their season ended, but yeah, it could be, and I think you've got Ryan Reynolds obviously very much invested in it, doing this the way I think it needs to be done. And this is not just like some one of many throwaway documentaries that are being thrown on Amazon or Netflix or wherever. This is something that obviously Ryan Reynolds himself is invested in the club, but also is going to be on a mainstream television channel in the United States and FX, and is going to, and Hulu has put an incredible amount of promotion into. I mean, quite frankly, I don't think I've seen a soccer documentary with this much promotion. And as I said, it's going to be on a mainstream platform in FX, and then obviously Hulu. We know the Disney bundle numbers, how many people have that in the United States. So I think in terms of U.S. audiences, at least, this is maybe the biggest one yet.
Yeah, I'm biased on this one too, because not only was I born in Wales, but also I have family that live just down the road from Wrexham, and that Wrexham's their local club. They've spent a lot of time in that area. And I hope too, in terms of the series, my expectations on this one is I hope we get a feeling for the connection that the club has to the community, and how important that is, not just for Wrexham, but for other clubs around the world, in terms of what it means to be a local fan in that area and what the club means to the actual community. That's what I'm hoping for. But yeah, no spoilers. Kartik, like you.
I was actually hoping Salford City documentary would be like that, but it ended up being a documentary about Nicky Budd and Gary Neville and right former United players.
Right.
Because I thought the same sort of thing. That's a local club, small in a borough of Manchester, but it didn't end up being about that. Although there were some elements of that. There were some good pieces to that documentary, which I believe ran a couple of seasons, and we You got it on, I can't even remember how we got in the U.S., Netflix or Prime or some one of the streaming services.
That's right. That's right. All right, listeners. So if you have any questions for us, any observations, any rants or raves, let us know. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to read those out on air. There's a few different ways you can contact us. One new way is voicemail. If you want to leave a voicemail, if that's easier, it's the phone number to call is U.S. 561-247-4625. Again, that's 561-247-4625. You can leave a voicemail there, or you can go ahead and send us an email. The email address is web@worldsoccertalk.com. You can also reach us on Facebook and send us a message through there. That's facebook.com/worldsoccertalk. And on Twitter, @WorldSoccerTalk. Plus, last but not least, on the website, worldsoccertalk.com, you can go ahead and click on the podcast and then the latest episode, and then just leave your comments in there, and we'd love to read those out on air. Hopefully next week. Hopefully we'll get to read those out to everyone. All right, listeners, thank you so much for sticking with us, and we're looking forward to having you back. Later this week, we're hoping to have an interview with an American multimillionaire who is an owner of a club in Europe, and we want to find out more details about his story and why he's investing in a club in Europe and what it's like in terms of being in the transfer market, in transfer window, and having to make some big decisions. So a real life example of a club owner in Europe. All right, Kartik, before we head out, where can listeners find you on Twitter?
Twitter at KKFLA737.
All right, listeners, thank you so much for listening, and heading into another midweek of football. We've got some League Cup matches, of course, and plenty of other football from around the world. Kartik, what should the listeners do, and what are you going to do?
Enjoy your football.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.